Hey guys, welcome back to a new episode of Jared and Cameron's podcast. We're gonna just jump right into it today. We kind of have a shorter podcast today because, you know, next week we want to have a really big one for our final episode before the new year. All right, Jared, let's get right into it. Yesterday, Patrick Corbin signed a 6-year, $140 million deal. Presuming he turned down like semi-big deals from the Phillies and the Yankees. What do you think about it?
Well, I think that yesterday what it came down to was no matter what, the Yankees weren't going to go a sixth year. And neither was Philadelphia. They'd give him about the same average, but just not the same amount of years. I think in comparison to a lot of recent starting pitching, you know, big marquee starting pitching contracts, I think this is a weird one because Corbin wasn't so great. There was a lot of potential for him before last year, but last year he really finally came into his own. And so now all of a sudden he's the hot commodity. He was the top pitcher on the market over guys like Keuchel, who has had more track record, which I think is a little interesting because you almost want the guy who's proven it many times when you're giving out this kind of money. And guys like Keuchel, I think, are less susceptible maybe to arm injuries because he doesn't rely on like a devastating slider or, you know, a power fastball. He's really a ground ball pitcher, which really suits him well. I think he is going to be an underrated signing wherever he goes because he did win a Cy Young and he's been a proven pitcher many years in Houston, which is a pretty good hitting park. I think that Washington overpaid, but I think that they felt so pressured to at least get someone. Even if they don't bring back Bryce, I think that they want it. They may not be looking at World Series. They may be looking at, can we put a good product on the field? And pitching can win you games. Pitching can keep you at least in the hunt for a long time. You know, the Mets had a terrible year, but DeGrom and Syndergaard and Wheeler kept them in it good enough. I think that they really liked being able to put Scherzer, Strasburg, and Corbin together. Two righties and a lefty. Rourke is your four. Maybe Joe Ross can have a healthy year and be your five. I think that they wanted to build a stable rotation. If Bryce leaves, we have a product to put out on the field. If Bryce stays, we're a serious threat to Atlanta and to the National League.
Here's what this tells me. This tells me that the Nationals were taking a hearty approach to a market that they knew was going to be tough. With Harper, they want to prove to Harper that they're the team for him. They didn't trade him at the deadline, which we talked about in our first episode. They didn't trade him at the deadline, which is, you know, we're thinking like, is that a huge mistake? Because maybe he's, you know, gone forever and you still have these young prospects, these young guys. Soto, Strasburg is still pretty young. Serger is going to be your ace. But you know what this tells me? This tells me that they're still in the hunt for some key players. And even though that the NL East is probably the best division in baseball right now, that they still want to go out there and win it. Something that's interesting to me is that the Yankees didn't offer him more than 5 years, and he is... I can't see why they didn't offer him an option, like somewhere, a club option in the fifth year or both a player and... a team option for the 6 year. That surprised me because, you know, they only offered him 5 years according to John Paul Morosi. You know, it's just weird where the Yankees are right now because they did get Paxton, but Paxton's a little older. So I'm just kind of confused where they're going.
For some reason, everybody likes Jay Happ. Jay Happ was a middle-of-the-road guy for so many years. I think it's a little bit of who's available. I think New York isn't done. I don't think Washington is done. And I don't think Philadelphia is done. I think New York is now going to... They're gonna have money and they're going to spend it. They now may put that into either a Machado or a Harper or into a Happ and many relievers. I don't think they're done. I think Philadelphia, for me, I think... there's no better fit than Bryce Harper in Philadelphia. He fits well in that city. He fits well in that team. He's like a true right fielder. You can just stick him in there. They got rid of Santana, which proved to me that We want to create room in our outfield. Let's move Reese Hoskins back to first base where he should have been all along. Should never have moved him back out there. The Santana signing, he's a good player. It didn't make sense for them there. And now they had to bite the bullet a little bit by trading his contract off and having to get rid of J.P. Crawford. But although I do like Segura. I think
that makes the Phillies a better team.
I think he definitely makes them a better team. He's a 300 hitter who's going to play some good defense, get on base, steal some bases. He's a real, you know, if you have 9 Gene Seguras in the field, you're going to win a championship. He's a solid MLB starter.
You know what surprised me through all of this, through all of this kind of transition to the Mariners, is that, you know, you have a team that is almost there. Almost there. You trade Paxton, you trade Cano, you trade Edwin Diaz, you trade Segura, and you're probably going to trade Gordon.
Yeah.
You know, your whole core of guys are all gone when you're almost there. It's just kind of like, why are you doing...
Were they as good as Houston? Were they as good as Boston and New York?
For half the season.
This rebuild needed to happen a few years ago.
Well, yes, that's true. That's what I'm saying. Like, why did you do all of this now? Why did you do all of this now? And like, you got the Ben Gamel. You got, like, those are good pieces you could start working. You got the Mitch Haniger. What do you do from there?
I think getting, you know, accepting Santana to get J.P. Crawford was interesting. Because Crawford, I was looking at some past MLB top 100 prospects. Number 2, number 5. He was a top 5 prospect back-to-back years. People really think highly of him. He didn't have such a great year last year. But not many rookies come in their first year and totally light it up. I mean, it's happened recently, yeah. But you can't expect that. That's not fair. I think that was a good trade for them. The Cano trade with Diaz. You know, you got 2 top 100 prospects. And you got another prospect. You could have gotten a lot more had you just traded Diaz. Because nobody wanted that Cano contract. First, you would have had to have taken Bruce and Swarzak. So that's one thing. Then, why? Unless you can truly tell me that you had no other ability to trade Robinson Cano.
I think they wanted to trade him.
No, they wanted. He was the guy. They wanted to trade Cano.
And Diaz was the guy.
They wanted to trade Cano. However, I would have done it in 2 separate deals. Unless you can definitively tell me that there was no way you could have traded Cano without, you know, putting either in Diaz or somebody else or like a Haniger or somebody who's good just to get rid of that contract, unless you could tell me that there was no possible trade, I believe somewhere they may have had to take it eating a little bit more salary, but is it worth the salary if you're getting the prospects?
The whole situation is confusing to me. From a Mets standpoint, I don't know why their fans are going crazy over Cano. Cano's a declining player. Yes, he probably will have 2-3 years left. But you're going to have him until he's almost 40 years old, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not so in love with that. And, you know, Diaz, he did have a great year. But look at Zach Britton. You know, look, you know, this is what I'm saying. Relievers aren't...
Relievers have good years and they have bad years. And it's, honestly, I don't know how much there is consistency. Because there was a year where Andrew Miller was the top guy. There's a year where Craig Kimbrell was the top guy. Hey, this was last offseason. Everybody loved Kenley Jansen.
Yep, that's true.
Everybody loved Kenley Jansen. Yeah. He has a tough start to the year. His numbers look bad because a reliever could have 3 bad games and his numbers don't look good. I think that relievers aren't totally trustworthy. And one other example is, I'm an Angels fan, so I kind of, you know, have a better understanding of guys and what happens there is Blake Parker in 2017 was great. He was like our guy. But he was really bad in 2018. With relievers, you just can't totally count on them year in and year out. The ones who you can count on, they're rare. They're once in a decade. And those guys are Hall of Famers. And that's why there aren't many Hall of Fame relief pitchers.
I mean, we can get into that a little too. Because the Hall of Fame ballots are coming in.
There, you know, if you guys want to, there's a person on Twitter called Ryan Thibodeau. He tracks ballots. People send in ballots, and they send in who they voted for. So we can go into that actually. Currently on his tracker, he has received 15 ballots. And so what that does is it tells you kind of like a projected of what could happen for these guys, how many votes they need. So to run through a few of the names, of course, Rivera's at 100%. Edgar Martinez is at 100%.
I swear, if Mo does not get 100%, you know, there's always going to be that one baseball writer, or more than one, that's going to be like, oh, Mo's going to get in, obviously, so why put him on a ballot?
Well, you know, there's going to be that guy who doesn't send in a ballot because he's angry. But, I mean, I think that you have to think about what the player thinks. Does Mariano Rivera give a damn if he gets 97% or 100%? Like, he's going to get a high percentage. He's going to get in. Like, there's not a question. He's going to get in. Roy Halladay, he's an interesting case because this hasn't really ever happened before. You know, it was the tragedy of last year. He passed away. The last time something like that happened was with, I guess, Roberto Clemente. But that was...
If Halladay gets in, we've talked about this, then I think CeCe should get in. Because that he's going to be the start of the new wave pitcher that gets in.
But Halladay's different than Sabathia. Halladay pitched complete games. Halladay had a far better ERA, better ERA plus.
You say that, but it's...
Won Cy Young's. He was dominant wherever he went.
But the difference between Halladay and CeCe is CeCe was able to pitch for a longer amount of time and reinvent himself. Halladay lost it.
But he didn't. He pitched consistently for many years. Sabathia became a solid pitcher at some point. Sabathia is...
But after 2011, Halladay was missing.
Well, you can compare Sabathia to is AJ Andy Pettit. And Andy Pettit's getting 20% right now on the ballot.
I mean, he won't get in. He's not a Hall of Famer.
Sabathia has a career 2.370 ERA in comparison to Halliday's 3.38. That's just not okay.
But the difference is if CeCe pitches this year has a 3.6 ERA the same way he did, then you're gonna look and go, oh, this was a guy for 20 years almost, 18 years, a guy for 18 years that pitched an average of 3.6 ERA. That in our day of baseball where people don't pitch 9 innings anymore, they pitch 5, and when you give up 2 earned runs in 5 innings, it's gonna give you an ERA of 3.5. So you gotta pick your poison here.
But that's not Hall of Fame. Sabathia's ERA is not Hall of Fame worthy. If you look up the leaders of ERA,
then why don't we go into strikeouts then?
Cause strikeouts, when you pitch 18 years, strikeouts goes out the window. Strikeouts then becomes a compiled statistic. If you pitch long enough...
He's 14 away from 3,000 strikeouts and 250 wins. And I know, I hate the win stat too, but wins...
Wins, I think voters have... That is out the window. Because nobody's going to get to 300 wins. Nobody gets to it.
All right, let's get into this next week. That was a little preview right there. Let's move into NFL. Mike McCarthy just got fired from the Packers. How do you feel about that?
I think that you can really look at this both ways because, okay, you give him an opportunity to find a job earlier, and now teams know he's out there, and teams may say, wait, we like him more than the guy we have. So you could say that helps him. However, how many times does a team fire a guy who won a Super Bowl for them midway through a season? I think it's a little strange. I think a lot of it is dictated by Aaron Rodgers.
So long ago, though.
And so what I'm upset about with Aaron Rodgers is this. I think he has... You know, I've watched... The Packers are on TV a lot. And every time they get a 3-and-out, he always seems upset at a teammate or a coach. It almost feels like it can never be his fault. When they lose, it's not his fault. You can blame the guys around him. And that's been fair because you can blame the general manager and the player development program for not getting the players around him. Because if you have Aaron Rodgers, like you have Mike Trout, you should win. Like, that should be almost a given. I think that there should be some blame on Aaron Rodgers because great players make it work.
No, here's the difference, you know. Mike McCarthy, even the past 3-4 years, just, you know, the team has been so bad, like, I don't want to say chemistry-wise, but, like, so badly put together. And, you know, if you're sitting in you're the general office of Green Bay, you know, you have to find a scapegoat. We find this in every single sport. And they're scapegoating Mike McCarthy, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe he's just not the guy for them right now. And he was 7 years ago when they won the Super Bowl. But, you know, it's different. It's really different. You know, this guy, this isn't like they fired. Well, he was the second longest tenured NFL coach.
Yeah,
next to Bill Belichick. But the difference is that Bill Belichick, you know, Bill Belichick is a five-time Super Bowl champion. Mike McCarthy has been coaching an average team for the past 5 years.
I don't think he's done a great job, but I don't know if what the job he was doing was worthy of being fired. Although, you know, you can't lose to Arizona at home. I know that.
Yes, I know you can't lose to Arizona
at home. It's crazy. You know, the NFL has really picked up steam. You know, it's going to be a really big, interesting end to the season. And how the playoffs shake out is going to be different because, and when it gets colder out, let's see if whose offense can stay hot.
Mm.
You know, teams. What if a team has to go into Chicago? And their offense.
That's the only team I could
see. They're the most interesting team because they don't play like everybody else does. They play grit and grind defense, even though they have a great offensive you know coach in Charles Nagy. Well, so that's a shorter podcast for this week. Next week is our season recap. We're going to go over, you know, some of the biggest things. It'll be a longer podcast, definitely. We're going to try and get closer to an hour, if that's possible. We want to thank you again for listening, and we'll see you next week.